It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new federal report raises questions about the quality of hospice care in the United States. We'll find out what things look like here in Wisconsin. Now,
T-minus 10, 9, 8. We have a go for main engine start. We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
That was liftoff, and 50 years ago this weekend, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong became the first humans to set foot on the moon. It was a big moment for the country and the world. But our next guest says the story of how it actually came to be was more complicated than the one we often hear today, and that we need to understand that to understand the program's full legacy. Roger Lanius is a former chief historian at NASA. He's also former associate director of collections and curatorial affairs at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. His new book is called Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. Roger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Your book tells the story of the moon landing, but also the story of how we remember the moon landing. Why is it important to look back on the different stories we tell about the moon landing?
Yeah, you know, the moon landing has all of these sort of meaningful elements to it. And most of us, when we think back on it today, we view it as this unadulterated triumph, that we, as a nation, rallied behind a president's desire to go to the moon. We made it happen, and we all celebrate that as a great victory. And there's clearly a lot of truth to that, and we can certainly use it as an exemplar of our American capabilities and our exceptionalism as a nation. But it's more than that as well, and we need to remember the other pieces to it.
Looking back at the politics of the moon effort, I mean, this is like anything we look at in politics today. There was political fighting over the budget. There was bureaucratic fighting over this. It was politics as usual in the United States in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely. Again, we sort of see it as this great marching triumph, but the political processes to get there were very difficult. There were people literally on both sides of the political aisle who objected to it. They thought the money could be spent in other ways, different ways depending on your political leanings, but nonetheless in different ways. And it was never a foregone conclusion. It was going to turn out the way it did.
I want to listen to President John F. Kennedy's famous moon speech at Rice University in Texas. This is in 1962.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
You know, listening to when they applauded there, it sounds like they were applauding the Rice-Texas football game as much as the moon. But can you talk about, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that John F. Kennedy was going to make this push for the space program. Can you talk about what was going on in his administration that led up to this kind of speech?
Oh, absolutely. So in the spring of 1961, I mean, you've got a young new president who's just taken office in January of that particular year. And he's had a whole series of setbacks all through the spring. And two of them really sort of come to a head near the same time in April, the 12th of April, when Yuri Gagarin flies around the world, a Soviet cosmonaut, the first person in space, and he becomes an overnight sensation. He becomes a celebrity worldwide. And, of course, the Soviet Union uses this as an example of how the Russian model, the Marxist model, is the way in which the future is going to be defined, and this is a great thing. And within a week of that, Kennedy faces a setback when his CIA-backed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba fails to overthrow Castro. And so you've got a Soviet success coupled with a very public American failure. And Kennedy decides at that point, I've got to do something to sort of change the subject, to regain the momentum moving forward. And it's that point in which he just says, okay, what can I do? Let's do it in space. And what can I do that will beat the Russians at? And we have to understand that larger Cold War context as critical to this.
But a big what if that I didn't know about till I read your book, there were a couple of approaches to say, hey, what if this was a joint operation? U.S., Soviet Union, we right. work together to get to the moon.
Yeah, no, there was all kinds of opportunities, and they could have pursued those and may well have had Kennedy's assassination not taken place in the fall of 1963. But within a few days after announcing the Apollo program in May of 1961, he's already starting to have second thoughts. And he does propose to Khrushchev in their one and only summit meeting in June of that year, you know, maybe we could turn this into a joint effort. And Khrushchev's response was sort of noncommittal and nothing came of it. But after a very tumultuous fall of 1961 and into 62, but after the Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of 62, when tensions lessen a little bit, Kennedy revisits the idea and comes back to it. And that was clearly on his mind in the fall of 1963, not long before his assassination.
Talking to Roger Lanius, former chief historian at NASA. His new book is Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. Roger, attention all through the mission, the landing itself, and in the way people talk about it is, was this a great American achievement or was this a great human achievement? And it's a little of both, it seems like.
Absolutely it is. Obviously, this is an American activity, and Americans took great pride in the fact that they were able to accomplish this. But if you were not an American and you're watching this from name the nation of your choice, you could be quite proud of the fact that humanity had now done this. These were not just representatives of the United States. They were representatives of all humankind. And it sort of gets said that way when the astronauts reach the moon in 1969. They do raise the American flag, of course, and it's the only flag that is raised on the moon. But they also say we came in peace for all mankind. And that includes everybody, and we could all feel good about that, regardless of where you're from.
And you write that it wasn't live televised in the Soviet Union, but the Soviet media did treat the American astronauts as celebrities in some ways and kind of celebrated this, even with all the animosity.
Oh, no question about that. I mean, the Cold War is a very real issue all through this time frame, but literally around the world, regardless of where you were, on which side of the Cold War you might have been, or in a you know in a democratic nation or one that was totalitarian, there is genuinely a larger perspective where people pay attention and they are excited and proud of this achievement.
On the one hand, as you say, the astronauts in the space program represented all humanity, but you say even at the time there are questions about whether they even represented the United States. It was a very particular category of person who went into the space program.
Yeah, no question about that, too. I mean, these were all white males. Most of them, and they were not unlike a lot of white males of the time period, most of them came out of a middle class or maybe even a lower middle class background. They're often the first generation in their family to attend college. Most of the time they're educated in either a state university in a technical program of some kind or at one of the military service academies. And in that sense, they do not come into this with a sort of an elite approach to things. And they're very much our avatars as we undertake these moon missions. They represent a lot of what we think about ourselves as being good and decent, middle class, and so forth. But they did not include any women. They did not include any minorities. And that was a failing on the part of NASA and the larger efforts of the time frame. It would not be until the 1970s when the first minority and women astronauts were selected at NASA.
Talking to Roger Lanius, formerly of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum and former chief historian at NASA, talking about his new book, Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were there watching on TV, tell us about your memory of the moon landing. How did you feel when you watched it? What did people talk about at the time? What do you think about the achievement now, 50 years later? If you were, like me, born after the moon landing, how do you look back on it? What were the stories you heard? What does it mean for the United States, for the world? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation about the Apollo space program and the moon landing that celebrates its 50th anniversary this weekend. Roger Lanius is with us, former chief historian at NASA. He's the author of Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were around at the time, if you were watching, what do you remember? What did you think of this? A unique moment in human history. Is it worth it to do it again? Should we have another moonshot effort to get to the moon, to Mars, or as a metaphor to do something else? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Menominee Falls. Lisa, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to share with you my experience with the Apollo moon mission. So I was a very young girl, and I was asleep, actually. And I think I was still in a onesie with the feet. Gives you an idea of what time frame we're looking at here. But I remember my mother waking me up, and I didn't want to be woken up. And she said, no, this is really important. And I remember thinking, wow, I don't think my mother's ever said those words to me. So I shook myself awake and paddled down the hallway. And my siblings were around. We have this big Magnavox floor model TV, very advanced for the time, one with the carved wood and all. And they let me sit right in front, cross-legged on the floor in my little footy pajamas. I remember watching, and when Armstrong's foot hit the moon, I remember we all just cheered, and everybody laughed a little bit, and we clapped. And I remember, because we were watching in the dark, I remember turning around and looking at my father, who was a World War II veteran, and he was so proud and so happy, I think, for America in that moment. I think he realized what that would mean for our future. And I do hope that we do start spending a lot more money on space and on science. I'm all for it.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Roger, that highlights something. This people had a sense that this was a historic moment. This was a wake up the kids to watch TV moment.
No question about that. It was remarkable. Those who were alive at the time, and I'm a child of Apollo. We all sort of paused, if only for a short period of time, to take all of this in and to participate in it vicariously and to really be excited about it. And it really didn't matter where you were or what your background was. This was one of those great experiences in human history. And a lot of the things that we remember that are such big events in our lives, they're usually negative events. I mean, everybody knows where they were at the time of the 9/11 attacks and how they heard about that. But that's a horrible story. This is a great story, one in which we really can take pride in.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Phil now in Lake Mills. Phil, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Phil?
Well, at that time in 1969, a lot of us were much more concerned about the young Americans dying in Vietnam than we were about the Apollo program. And the U.S. space program had been beset by many disasters in the 1960s.
Phil, thanks a lot for the call. And there was a lot going on in the late 60s, Roger, than just the moon landing. How did this event stack up against this backdrop of the Vietnam War, social unrest, rioting in American cities across the country?
Yeah, you know, there's no question that the latter 1960s especially were tumultuous times in the United States. And you've got, you know, the Civil Rights Crusade that is in full bloom, but then violence associated with that, with the assassinations of Martin Luther King and others. And obviously the war in Vietnam and the divisive nature of that. And how that affected us as a people. And those are stories that are absolutely significant, and we can't not minimize how important they truly are. What is remarkable, though, about the moon landings is that although there were those who thought the money could have been better spent elsewhere, virtually everybody was willing to step up at the point that the actual flight of Apollo 11 took place and said, you know, this is something that we should be proud of.
Thanks for the call, Phil. We're talking to Roger Lanius about his new book, Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings. Roger, you write about how the moon landing became a metaphor for us in a lot of ways. The line, if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we blank, or we need a moonshot effort to do whatever. How did this shape the way we think about tackling big projects?
Well, it changed the nature of this. I mean, one of the things we did learn, and it's a true statement, that, you know, if whatever we sort of set our mind to, that, well, I shouldn't say sort of, do set our mind to, we can make real inroads toward resolving those challenges. And the moon landings helped demonstrate that that was possible. With enough concerted effort, enough brain power, enough resources behind it, we could really change the world. And we've demonstrated that over and over again since.
On the other hand, you write that in some ways this was not a sustainable project. It ended just a few years later, and then we stopped the Apollo program, went on to the space shuttle eventually, but it didn't really open the door to wider human exploration beyond orbit.
No, not in terms of space flight. There's no question that the end result of that were the lunar landings, and that was because of the political nature of what we were doing and why we were doing it. Because of the Cold War objective that was a part of it. And we haven't had anything approaching that since that time in which the right answer to some problem is to undertake a lunar base or a mission to Mars or whatever it happens to be. So we'll have to wait for that in the future.
You also devote a chapter to conspiracy theories, moon landing denialism. When did this start?
Almost immediately. You know, the science, the chief science correspondent for the New York Times wrote a story at the time of the moon landings in which he said he walked into a bar in Chicago and there were a bunch of barflies sitting there while the flight's taking place, and they're spouting off about how, oh, these guys, you know, they can fake anything in Hollywood. You know, they're just doing this on a soundstage. So, you know, it's present from the very beginning. It really got a voice in a pretty fundamental way in the internet age, where anybody can put anything they want online and there's not any barriers to entry for them.
What is the appeal of moon landing denialism, if that's the phrase for that particular genre of conspiracy theory?
Yeah, that's as good a phrase as any. Probably the fundamental thing about it is that it's sort of a juxtaposition of a distrust of government and authority on one side and a sense that in a statement that I know something you don't know and here's the secret. And I think those are sort of the drivers that push people to say things about it. Those that believe it, some of them are probably a little less sophisticated from a technical perspective than others. Might be, and they just don't understand the nature of how you could possibly do this. But that's sort of the key drivers, I think.
That reminds me of a kind of a funny story about the flag planting. Denialists say, oh, look, it looks like the flag is flapping in the wind. There's no wind on the moon. Why is the flag all bent out of shape in that famous picture?
Yeah, it's a pretty simple task. A pretty simple reason. One is they had a telescoping rod that had to be pulled out to the side for the flag to hang on, since there's no air on the moon and no breeze to blow it. And they bent that telescoping rod the first time that they tried to put it out, and so it sort of hung down and looks like it's sort of flapping in that particular context.
And it became a tradition for the few years of moon landings. Other astronauts tried to replicate that look?
Yeah, they liked it, and they thought, well, yeah, okay, let's do that too. So they would end up, they would bend it intentionally.
Now, there's talk on and off in American history since then of what the next big thing is going to be for space exploration, publicly funded, privately funded, moon, Mars, whatever, humans on it, not humans on it. What are you watching for as our space program moves into the future?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we're going to see moving forward, and probably, you know, who knows exactly what the timeline is going to be for this, but I think we will see a continuation of the international consortium that is taking on the International Space Station today and is operating it. We will probably see that continue at some level with, I would say, an international group that will undertake a moon landing sometime. Hopefully in the next decade or so.
Are we able to plan long-term enough? Because it seems like, you know, this was this 7-8 year effort from announcement to completion. And it seems like with changes of administration, changes in Congress, our goalposts keep shifting. Do we have the capacity to say we're going to commit to something for the decade or decades it takes to accomplish it?
No question it's hard to do, but it can be done. You know, when, yes, the Apollo program lasted only a short period of time, you know, but about a decade. But the space station program has been operating since the early 1980s, and it's still operational today. So we can sustain things over a long period of time.
Roger, a lot of people, I think, were inspired by the Apollo program to pursue sciences or engineering or related issues. Did the moon landing inspire your choice of a career that brought you to NASA as their chief historian?
Well, I mean, maybe yes and no. I was jazzed by the Apollo program, and I was going to become a science major, and I tried that, but I couldn't handle the math, so I opted for history, but. Be that as it may, I did find my way to work in one of the greatest organizations ever established, one committed to doing really cool, important things for all of humanity.
Roger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Roger Lanius, former chief historian at NASA. He's with us today as we approach the 50th anniversary of the moon landing this weekend to talk about his book, Apollo's Legacy, Perspectives on the Moon Landings.